Well, it's an absolute honour and a privilege to be asked to come and speak here at Kennet Valley this morning. And I want you to know that since I came to St Matthew's 4.5 years ago, I've kind of held Kennet Valley up in my mind as a really great church, something to aim for. And I mean that. I really, really mean that. Because, you know, when Kirsty and I first moved to Southcote, I started getting to, you know, to know the area. One of the things, obviously, you do is kind of find out what churches there are and what's going on and so on. And to be honest, the Anglican churches were not doing well. You know, just a couple of years before we came, the doors of St. Barinus, the Church of England church in Calcot, had closed. And although there were some lovely, faithful people at St. Matthew's, it had no young families whatsoever, and the situation in this part of Reading reminded me of an article many years ago that was brought to my attention in Private Eye magazine, which was headed, God to Leave the Church of England. And it said this, it said, following the example set by former members of the church, God has indicated that he too is to leave the Church of England. According to sources close to God, he's been unhappy for some time with the direction the church is taking and has now finally had enough. A Church of England spokesman said, losing God is a bit of a blow, but it's just something we'll have to get used to. Well, it kind of felt a bit like that in this area of Reading as far as the Church of England went. And to be honest, the other two Southcote churches were similarly struggling, with very few, if any, young people. And so Kennet Valley was the only living proof that a healthy church could exist in the 21st century in this part of town. And that was actually important encouragement for us and something to aim for. So we were also delighted when we established links early on with Andy Turnbull to discover that Kennet Valley was getting out in the community, into the schools, regularly doing Bible-based, gospel-centered assemblies at Manor Primary School, and Andy invited us to join in with that, which we've been doing ever since. So, it is great to be here with you this morning and to be invited to preach and to share a little bit about what God's been doing in our neck of the woods and to share from this passage in Hebrews. And I want to thank you for giving me such an amazing passage of Scripture to preach on, because I think these verses we've just heard Roy read contain the very heart of the letter to the Hebrews. So let's go there and take a look. I think the heart of this letter is summed up in just four words in verse 22. And they are, draw near to God. Now, you might think that my claim that these four words are the very heart of Hebrews is a little bit too neatly coincidental, landing right in the middle of the short passage that you've asked me to preach on. And so I just want to give you a brief overview of the structure of the letter, as I understand it, so you can see why I make that claim. The first verse of our passage begins, therefore. And of course, as we all know, when we see a therefore at the beginning of a passage, we know that it's referring to what's gone before. And it usually works something like this. First, the writer gives us some theology, some doctrine, some teaching about God and what he's done in Jesus. And then he says, therefore, and moves on to the application. In other words, what the reader is supposed to do or think or say in response to the theology and the teaching. So, that's how it goes. But, I hear you say, that's all very well, but it isn't the only therefore in the letter to the Hebrews. In fact, there are 16 if you count them up. So why is this the central one? Well, in the hope that it'll help you, perhaps it'd be good to think about Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Romans 12, as many of you know, begins with the verse, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices. All the chapters up to that point have been building up to his teaching about God in creation, the fall, God's righteousness, judgment, faith in the law, justification by faith in the law, justification by faith, life in the Spirit, Israel's unbelief, the gospel of salvation. And then in chapter 12, Paul writes, therefore, and then goes on to tell them in the rest of the letter how to live in response to the love of God in Jesus that's been explained in the previous chapters. And my suggestion here is that we've reached a very similar turning point in the letter to the Hebrews. Up to this point, we've been taken through some of the most amazing teaching about Jesus in the Bible, about him being God's final word, his superiority to angels, about his full humanity, that he's greater than Moses, that he's the great high priest in the order of Melchizedek, the certainty of God's promises, the power of Christ's blood, his once and for all sacrifice on the cross. And then at this point, at this particular therefore, the whole thrust of the letter changes from teaching us about Jesus to exhorting us to live in a proper response to his saving grace. And so it begins, therefore, verse 19. And in those first three verses, 19, 20, 21, there's a kind of little summary, a mini summary of much that's gone before in the letter. We're reminded that we can have confidence from chapter 4. That we can enter the holy place through the blood of Jesus from chapter 9. That we have a great high priest which runs right through chapters 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And because of all we've learned up to now, we are to respond. And how are we to respond? Well, we're to respond in verse 22 by drawing near to God. That's not the only thing that the writer asks us to do in this passage in response, but it's the main thing. It's the foundational thing from which all the others flow. But immediately we've said this, we kind of have a problem. You see, this letter is addressed to Christians. So the only way we can try to understand it is to imagine it being addressed to us here at Kennet Valley or at St. Matthew's. And for some Christians, it might be a bit hard to get our heads round. I mean, asking a church of believers to draw near to God seems to imply that we're not near to God now. And yet you might be thinking, well, hang on a minute. I read my Bible, I pray every day, I go to church on Sunday. What's the problem? Surely I draw near to God every time I pray, every time I open the scriptures, whenever I worship on a Sunday. This letter can't be for me. It must be for unbelievers or lapsed Christians or backsliders, but surely not me. What does the writer mean? Well, the context of the letter is really important. As John Stott writes, he says, this magnificent letter to the Hebrews was written to a group of first century Christians who were in danger of giving up. Times were hard, especially for Jewish Christians. Many of them faced harsh persecution. They'd been physically assaulted. Their homes had been plundered. Some had been thrown into prison. Many had been ridiculed. So they were in danger of giving up. And so it is into that context that the writer says, draw near to God. Now, why is that relevant to us? Because much of the Western church and many people in our churches are in much the same predicament. We may not be being physically assaulted or imprisoned, but the pervasive secularism, the pressure to conform and not to speak out or stand up, the temptation to believe the advertising slogans, the live and let live attitude, which ignores the consequences and says we can all make up our own gods just as we like. The culture of our day pervades not just our communities, but our churches, our families, our lives, and our very hearts. So yes, we too need to draw near to God. This letter is for us, for Christians who, like the Hebrews, constantly bombarded by pressures to take the easy way out and not the Jesus way. And so part of drawing near to God, of course, involves praying, reading scriptures, worshipping on a Sunday. All those things are vitally important to a vibrant Christian life. But I think there's a second thing we have to think about, which is that maybe perhaps we don't realize the enormity of what it means to draw near to God. What do I mean by that? Well, imagine if I said, drawing near to God is a bit like jumping into the ocean. Or imagine if I said, drawing near to God is a bit like running towards a fire. Or imagine if I said, drawing near to God is a bit like approaching some fierce lions. And yet, it was by walking on the water that Peter drew near to Jesus. It was through an encounter with a burning bush that Moses drew near to God. It was in the den of lions that Daniel experienced the power of God in his life. And I don't know about you, but for me, I find that the times that I've experienced the closeness of God more than any other are when I've taken risks for God, when I've had to depend on him, when it's required putting all my trust in him. And the first time that that happened was when I decided to become a Christian. It was 15 years ago. I was living in Mortimer at the time, not far away. I had a well-paid job as in software and industrial computers. I was married to Kirsty with two young teenagers, Tristan and Kylie. We weren't churchgoers. We never even really discussed faith. It didn't just figure in our lives. We'd got our children baptized as infants, as people with traditional Anglican roots often do, but only because it was expected of us by the family. None of our friends were Christians. None of them were churchgoers. And then on a business trip in March of 2000, I went to stay with an old buddy of mine, Chris, who lived in Johannesburg. And I hadn't seen him for many years, and he took me on the Sunday morning to a little church out in the bush near his weekend cottage. And in this church was nothing more. It was just a shade under the African sun. None of the trappings of church, no hymn books, no vicar, no priest, no pews, no organ. Nothing that I recognized as church. But in that church, with just a group of people worshipping God, God drew near to me, and I allowed myself to draw near to him. And in that 1 hour, my life was changed forever as his love poured into my heart. Do you know, I hadn't cried in 20 years, and I had tears pouring down my face, and I was doing a very bad job of trying to cover it. I was pouring sweat. I was shaking like a leaf, and it was only 9:30 in the morning. And I was an emotional wreck. And I knew for certain that nothing would ever be the same again. And that was the easy bit. I had to go home and tell my unbelieving wife and later my unbelieving friends that I had met God in Africa. And that scared the living daylights out of me. That was the first time I learned that drawing close to God was not a pious exercise or a nice cozy feeling, but a risky, high-octane adventure. And on such adventures, we can pick up scars. Last year, my daughter Kylie married a South African, and she lives there now. And in fact, she lives not far from the little church where my journey started. And while we were over there for the wedding, we visited a wild animal sanctuary with Kirsty, Tristan, and Kylie. And we went into some enclosures, one with lion cubs and the other with tiger cubs. And it was an amazing privilege, an incredible joy to interact with these wild animals. But I was also wary, because these cubs, I can tell you, they looked pretty big to me. So my son Tristan was sitting on the ground playing with one of the tiger cubs. And actually, just about a minute after this photograph was taken, it walked around behind him, jumped up behind, wrapped its paws around his head. And although it was only playing, when it drew back its paws, it had a claw dangling out. And it cut his head from here all the way round to here. And I think really the point I'm trying to make is that drawing close to God is a bit like that encounter. If it doesn't feel risky and exhilarating, and if you don't pick up some scars from time to time, then perhaps we're living too safe a Christian life. Perhaps we aren't risking our witness to family, friends, and colleagues because we're too anxious about the possible repercussions. Perhaps we haven't responded to God's call to preach or to take youth group or to invite non-Christian friends to evangelistic events because we're afraid of the scars we might pick up or the rejection we might suffer. So 6 months after my business trip to Africa, I went on an Alpha course at Greyfriars. And on the Alpha day away, in the middle of the course, I made a commitment to follow Jesus. And I got home that day, and I made the mistake of telling Kirsty that I'd given my life to Christ. And she said, uh-uh, the only person you gave your life to is me on our wedding day. And so I picked up a bit of a scar, not physically, you understand. But in the months that followed, we really did have the roughest time in our marriage. And when, by his amazing grace, God wooed Kirsty 18 months later and she came to faith, and then my daughter Kylie, and then he started to call me out of business into ministry, I was faced with another crisis. To train for ministry, I would have to say goodbye to the lovely family home, downsize, sell the nice cars, put an end to expensive holidays, and inflict all of this on the family. But God is so gracious, because the answer to every challenge, the answer to every problem is found in his word. And Matthew 6 told me, don't worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. And so I didn't. And we didn't. And actually, do you know what? We didn't miss any of it. But there were some scars. We lost some friends who didn't like our newfound faith. We gained dozens of new ones as we were welcomed into the church family at Greyfriars. And when I'd finished my training, God presented us with yet another challenge. It's dangerous to draw close to God. You see, most people who train at Greyfriars, which, as you know, is one of the larger evangelical Anglican churches, well, most of them go on to lead good-sized churches with well-established ministries for children and youth and evangelism and all that kind of thing. But God started speaking to me about St. Matthew's in 2009. Someone who was mentoring me at the time asked me to write my own obituary as a spiritual exercise. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever done this. It's a really fascinating thing to do. I honestly recommend it. Because the idea is this. The exercise is not to write about the life that you've already had, but to dream really big, to pray and dream really big, and then to write your obituary about the rest of your life viewed from the point of your death. And I found myself, I couldn't help it, I found myself writing about a ministry at St. Matthew's, Southcote. And in it, I described hundreds of young people pouring in and out of the church and the transformation of the community. And I just couldn't get away from it. I knew God was in it. And so we came to a struggling traditional church, which, with practically no young people, it couldn't pay the bills on a 1950s council estate. But by now, I was learning to trust. Because as verse 23 of our passage tells us, he who promised is faithful. And perhaps the most nerve-wracking moment of the whole adventure was the evening I stood in front of the congregation at Greyfriars 4 months before the move to Southcote and asked if there was anyone there who might feel God calling to come with us, because I was sure we couldn't do it on our own. They knew they'd be leaving a church with immense resources, wonderful ministries for every age, and going to a church of very few resources and no children, no youth. But once again, God provided. On the 23rd of June, 2011, 22 of us from Greyfriars joined 25 to 30 or so at St. Matthew's, and we commenced our journey. This was our first Sunday in June 2011. We had just three children on that day, all from one family who had come from Greyfriars, and it's been the most amazing journey. Since the church didn't have any, really, we decided that we had to prioritize families and children. And God sent us Lynn and Chris Everett, a husband and wife team who are now our children and youth workers. By the way, hands off, because I know Andy's leaving. So no. We started running half-term holiday clubs, and then inviting families who came on the holiday clubs to consider coming to church on a Sunday morning. Our first holiday club we ran in the half-term had about 60 children, 120 the next one, 150 the next one, over 200 in this last one. And I never miss being on team for holiday club, because I get to meet so many children and so many parents. And these holiday clubs are stuffed full of Christian content. Bible stories, exciting worship, object lessons, and they love it. My favourite moment, though, is at the end. Because what we do is we have in the church hall, we have 150 children on the benches. And then we get all the parents in round the back. And we cram them in so that they can see what's going on. And then they stand there, most of them not churchgoers, and they watch their children worship. One parent this year said to me, "It's amazing," she said, when I'm watching them worship," well, she didn't use the word worship, "when I watch them singing," she said, "the hairs on the back of my neck stand up and the shiver goes down my spine." And I thought, well, I can't wait till she discovers why. But it's been amazing. That was our first Sunday. And just to get a feel of the kind of demographic change, it's not about numbers, but demographic, this is the church fab. That was taken last summer. And so it's really, really come alive. One of the powerful things that Lynn and Chris taught us about was the witness of going out into the community. Something they'd done when they'd had run Lighthouse Kids Church years before. So the week after Holiday Club, every family who had a child at Holiday Club gets a visit, a knock on the door, an invitation, a personal invitation to come to church. And so last week we were out knocking about 90 doors. And once they start coming, they then get put on another list, and then they get a knock on the door every single week if they start to connect with church. But I have to say, it all sounds wonderful, but actual church growth isn't fast. Every time we run one of these big holiday clubs, maybe one or two families join the church, which is fantastic. But we're building long-term relationships with the community. And so we see it as much more of a marathon than it is of a sprint. But perhaps one of the most encouraging things I heard this year was after the Mayfair. The Mayfair takes place on Coronation Square in May, and all three Southcote churches work together and help out in running it. And I found myself talking to one of the Reading Borough councillors who doesn't come to St Matthew's. But he said to me, "You know, St Matthew's has become the conscience of the community." That's an amazing thing, isn't it? It's a really interesting comment because what he was saying in effect was that as a result of the Christian witness in recent years, people in the community actually think differently about life. They actually make decisions differently. And that's a humbling and powerful testimony to the work of God's Spirit in the lives of Christians in Southcote from all three churches. But anyway, I must return back to our letter, to the Hebrews. It's easy to get complacent. It's easy to get lazy. It's easy to give in to fear. It's easy to think, well, our church is okay. It's a really nice church family. We don't have to do anything different. We can just tick over the way we are. And we're constantly in danger of doing that at St. Matthew's as well. But the writer exhorts the Christians in verses 24 and 25 to spur one another on toward love and good deeds and to encourage one another. It's a well-known fact that if a church isn't moving forward, then it's moving backwards. And I think it's the same for individual Christians as well. If we're not allowing ourselves to be challenged and changed, then we're simply not really drawing close to God. Because he always challenges us. Jesus always challenged the people who drew near to him. He challenged the rich man to stop depending on money. He challenged Levi to drop everything and follow him. He challenged the woman to go and sin no more. He challenged Nicodemus to expand his vision of God. He challenged Jairus to believe that the dead could be raised. He challenged the Pharisees to end their hypocrisy. He challenged the woman at the well to believe he was the Messiah. He sent out the 12. He sent out the 72. He challenged his disciples to go and reproduce themselves in every nation on earth. We simply cannot draw near to God without being deeply challenged. That's why it's so important. Because drawing near to God is life-changing, and the gospel of Jesus is all about changed lives. Jesus' message of good news was repent. In other words, change your life. Why? Because the kingdom draws near. Nearness to God is transformational. The main thing that bolsters my faith, The thing that gets me out of bed in the morning and that gets me on my knees, that proves to me that Jesus has died for me, that he loves me, and that God calls me his son, is of course, yes, his promises in Scripture, but also the fruit that we see in transformed lives. Three of our young people, aged between 12 and 14, stood in front of church 2 weeks ago and told the congregation what it meant to them to be part of God's family at St. Matthew's. How they know God loves them, how they've come to know Jesus, how the knowledge of his love has helped them through some very, very difficult circumstances. One of them, the parents' marriage broke up two and a half years ago. But how their faith has helped them and changed their lives. A lady who has been coming to St. Matthew's for many years said recently, "I've been going to church all my life simply because I thought it was what you were supposed to do. But now I've found I can have a real relationship with God through Jesus." And it's changed her life, and everyone can see it. She's drawn close to God, and her faith has come alive. And for the first time in her life, she really, really, really loves God. And there's one more thing that gets me out of bed in the morning, apart from the fact that if I didn't, Kirsty would soon make sure I did. And that is the last words of our passage. "And all the more as you see the day approaching." You see, I know that although it's wonderful that there's a new generation of people, of young people growing up in the faith in Southcote, I'm very aware that there's still 90%+ of the population which does not have anything to do with church. And with every day that goes by, we get one day closer to the time when Jesus will return to judge the world. And it's no different today than when the writer of Hebrews penned those words. The day is approaching. And we all only have so many years to live ourselves. And so this adventure of sharing the good news is urgent. The world needs to hear it. And the question is, do we actually believe this? Do we actually believe that Jesus will return to judge the world? And the test of this sincerity must be not, do I think this in my head, but do I live it out in my life? Because we all know that actions speak louder than words. So do we really believe it, or do we at some level fall for the more comfortable, popular notion that God is love, and then at the end of the day he'll find a reason to let us into heaven, but otherwise he couldn't really be a loving God? And do you know, there was a time when I was training at theological college, I was wrestling with this. And one night I couldn't sleep thinking about it. And I got up and I spent the entire night going through the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I wrote down, I noted down every single time Jesus spoke of a coming judgment in which some would enter the kingdom and others would be shut out. And when the light of day crept in through my little bedsit window at college and I closed the Gospel of John, I had noted 57 occasions when Jesus tells us in the Gospels clearly that there is judgment and that there are consequences. And I still have that list. And it helps me to remember that the day is approaching and that it really, really matters what we do with our lives. Whether it's praying for people's salvation, whether it's witnessing to people in the workplace, gossiping the gospel over a cup of coffee, inviting people to evangelistic events, running holiday clubs, whatever it is. But let's be clear, whether a person comes to faith or not is not our responsibility. That's God's. But whether they get a chance to hear the good news most certainly is. So my encouragement to you is, draw near to God. Let him challenge you. Dare to risk that thing that he's calling you to. Encourage each other in your faith. It's so much more fun living the Christian life, taking risks, than playing safe. It's so faith-building to see God working powerfully in people's lives. One thing we've done at St. Matthew's over the last 4 years is to set what I call faith-filled budgets. Now, I hope your treasurer's not here, by the way, or if you're here, please put your hand over your ears at this point. Okay. So each year we've budgeted to spend about £30,000 more than we think we're going to get in income. But each year, we've broken even. And, you know, if we hadn't done that, there's a lot of things we wouldn't have done if we'd taken a conservative approach and played safe. And I believe that's God's provision when we step out in faith. One last thing I'll leave you with. Most of you will know who J. John is, I expect, yeah? You know J. John, the Christian evangelist and speaker? Well, I remember hearing J. John once speaking. And if you know J. John, you'll know that I saw that kind of naughty smile come on his face. And it always happens just before he lands a kind of killer punch, you know. And he said this: why is it that so many people pretend to be Christians when you can actually be one? And I kind of winced and I thought, oh Lord, am I just a pretend Christian? You know, oh, I don't want to be that, Lord. Surely I want to be a true follower of Jesus. You know, painful, isn't it, to hear? The writer of Hebrews asks us to draw near to God, to hold unswervingly to the faith we profess, to spur one another on to love and good deeds. Imagine this part of Reading, with all the Christians in all the churches drawing near to God together, leaping into deep water, running towards the fire, entering the den of lions, risking that adventure. Imagine our communities transformed by the witness of the faithful who have themselves been transformed in the presence and the fire of God's love. Now that's a vision worth getting out of bed for.